Counseling and Referral. You have a problem, maybe I can help you. By Father Joseph C. Martin. Father Martin.
I'm always after a good meal, I'm putting mine in. This is a magnificent story about two English kids. They were born next door to each other and grew up together. They were great rivals. Tremendous rivals. Two brilliant, brilliant kids. And at the end of every year, you know, the report cards would come out, and one year one of them would be like a half of a point above the other. And it was this way all through their careers. One went to Oxford, one went to Cambridge. Same way through their university days. They were almost parallel all the way through. Well, they each graduated. And the last they saw of each other was on the day of graduation. One went into the Anglican Navy, one went into the Anglican priesthood. The English Navy and the Anglican priesthood. Anyways, again, they were great rivals. Their talent, of course, catapulted each one of them to the top. As the years went by, the Navy officer ultimately achieved the rank of High Admiral of the British Navy. And the other man, as the years went by, made it to the top. He became Archbishop Canterbury. Only one peculiarity, the Archbishop grew not only in age and grace and wisdom before God and man, but also in girth. He gave birth to a huge pot belly. He was a gigantic man. Now, neither had seen the other all these years. Neither knew what the other looked like. Quite by accident, after 31 years of being separated, they met. Now, the only contact they had, each one would mail the other a Christmas card at Christmas and would sign it with his name, comma, and then the latest promotion, underlined. They met in a train station. And here's the British Admiral in all of his finery. He was covered with more brass than you can imagine. He had medals and ribbons and braid all over him. And the Archbishop is there, huge, in his flowing red cassock, and he spotted the Admiral first. I went up to him, he tapped him on the shoulder. Of course, when the Admiral turned around, he was shocked. He recognized his old buddy immediately, see? But before he could say anything, the Archbishop looked at his uniform and said, "Porter, would you put my bag on that train over there?" And the old Admiral took a reading on this gigantic figure in front of him. Huge belly, flowing red robe, and he said, "Madam, in your condition, you shouldn't be traveling at all." Actually, that doesn't have anything to do with anything. I just thought I'd tell that. Well, anyways, I'd like to begin this afternoon by simply offering a little information as a result of a suggestion. At the end of the last talk, someone said, there may be those who would question the fact that, you said the only place to learn about alcoholism is from alcoholics. If I gave that impression, I did not intend to. All other things being equal, I maintain that the best teacher is the one who has the edge of experience. That's all I meant. So please understand the context in which I said it. There are many knowledgeable men and women in the field of alcoholism who have not suffered the disease themselves. And there are many who, in my opinion, are far more qualified than many recovered alcoholics. I didn't mean that at all. I simply mean that all other things being equal, an alcoholic has the edge of his own experiential knowledge that he has picked up from having been there. Okay, guideline number 4. Confront the alcoholic with the fact of his illness. Now, ladies and gentlemen, immediately there comes a kind of conflict in the minds of many between AA's reticence and this guideline. in going out to help the alcoholic. And for those of you who are members of AA, I would simply say this. As an organization, AA attracts rather than promotes. This is one of its traditions. And so AA as an organization doesn't go out and lasso drunks off of bar stools and slam them into meetings. Let's all acknowledge that. What I'm saying is that the 12th step of AA therapy, in order to retain one's sobriety, one must share it, and one must do this actively rather than passively. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry the message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. This is a teaching of Bill Wilson, the man who started it all. With that as a preface, the alcoholic has deceived, of all people, he has deceived himself most. Any alcoholic who says anything out loud ultimately believes it. And when he says, "I don't have a problem," he believes that, even though the whole world knows it. And many an alcoholic will literally go to his grave believing that no one knows anything about his drinking because nobody said anything. Nobody has said anything. And so we confront the alcoholic with the fact of his illness. You have a drinking problem. Now, I'd like to make a few comments about this confrontation. I would strongly suggest that it makes no sense at all to point out a problem unless you can point out its solution. I want to tell you something about myself. I have learned this after many years. The day I get too old to learn, I'm just too old. But I also know this. If you have something to say to me that is a correction or a reprimand, please say it with love. There are two people in my life. When they talk, I listen. One's a man, one's a woman. And I listen for this reason. They love me enough that they tell me what is wrong with me only that I might profit from it. I know this so that when they do, I do two things. I thank them and I act on it. And if you care enough about me to want me to be a better person and you offer me a correction that will indeed be embarrassing or painful or shameful or whatever, I'll do two things to you. I'll thank you and I'll act on it. Took me a long, long time to arrive at that. But don't you dare come up to me and just say, "You have this wrong with you." If you can't offer me a solution to it, I'm going to know two things about you. Number one, you're moralizing. Number two, you're condescending. And number three, you're going to learn something about me. I ain't going to be listening. I'm going to be busy bending over to pick up a club to apply to your skull. It means absolutely nothing to go up to a man who is dying of alcoholism and say, "You have a problem with your drinking." Unless you can say, "And I know where you can get help and I'll take you there." Now, when you can add that, he might be listening. I don't know whether he will or not. But for God's sake, don't confront him unless you can give him the answer to his problem. This is where it pays to go to some AA meetings, because you will know where to take him. And you might be willing to take him there. How should the confrontation be made? Watch this for a perfect cop-out answer. Properly. Ain't that a beauty? What's that mean? Well, what it means is by the right person with the right words in the right place and at the right time. Now, what's the answer to that? I don't know. If I had the answer to that, I could save a nation. But I know this, what is proper for one is not for another. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a purely judgmental thing. And it takes great prudence, common sense, and experience. And then, in 4 out of 5 cases, you will be cursed for your pains. But you see, let's go back to guideline 3. Alcohol controls him. If you know that, you know what his reaction will probably be, and you'll come to expect it. Why do alcoholics lie? Why do they meet a confrontation with hostility and everything else? Because this is all a threat to his drinking. Now, these hints that I have picked up from other people, and I'm about to go over with you now, for gosh sake, they are general statements. Please realize that. They are general statements. Any general statement brooks of exceptions. So, number one, you normally don't talk to an alcoholic when he's drunk. He's all drugged up. It's the same thing as in that chalk talk. I said it doesn't make any sense for a doctor to try to apply psychiatric therapy to somebody that's half drugged with ether. Just doesn't make sense. Same way with the alcoholic when he's drunk. And I honestly believe that very rarely do you approach an alcoholic when he's sober, because he's there with two fielder's mitts. He's been ready for years for whatever comes his way to field him and throw him back and so on. Many an alcoholic can just zing people around his little finger when he's sober. You talk to many an alcoholic about his drinking when he's sober, and in 2 minutes, he'll give you enough reasons for his drinking, you're just liable to say, wait, I'll get my hat and go with you. When then do you approach an alcoholic? Suggestion? When he's in pain. When he's hurting. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure that every one of us in this room has read somewhere along the line pamphlets or books on human motivation. One thing motivates alcoholics to get well. It's the cleanest four-letter word in English. P-A-I-N. And what's the principle behind it? When you hurt bad enough to want to quit hurting, then you'll do something to stop the pain. This is a little bit of general American history that most people don't know. You know that toilet seat that is, it's built like a horseshoe, you know, it has that opening in the front? Most toilet seats are built that way. That was invented by an alcoholic. He got tired of getting hit in the back of the neck. When you hurt bad enough to want to quit hurting, you will do something to stop the pain. They cut that section out. Boom. It's true, though. Many people say, well, the alcoholic will get well when he wants to. There's only one thing that's going to make him want to, and that's pain. Now, the pain can be of many kinds. The least is physical. Alcoholics go through hell after hell of physical pain and go back for more. I'm talking about the mental and the emotional pain that results from years of drinking. I'm talking about a conscience that is in such pain that very rarely can the alcoholic tolerate even a bit of sobriety, because then his conscience would kill him. In some, it is a thing called soul sickness. Soul sickness. Ask any alcoholic. He has usually reached a point in his drinking career when he is given probably God's greatest gift to the human being. He looks into a mirror and has an overwhelming desire to puke because he can't stand what he's looking at. That's the pain, the gut pain, that brings most alcoholics to their knees. And ultimately it proves to be God's greatest gift. Someday I'd like to come back and just talk about pain. There's a great deal to be said about it. Maybe someday. Anyways, do you know of any alcoholic who busted out of bed on a beautiful summer day and said, gee, it's a lovely day, I think I'll go to AA from a drinking problem? Nobody comes into treatment that way. Every alcoholic is forced into it by one means or another. I humbly submit for your consideration that for the 3 or 4 alcoholics who offer hostility to a confrontation, there's the alcoholic who has been waiting for it for 1, 2, or 5, or 15 years. What alcoholic is going to bust up to a stranger or even a friend and say, look, I think I have a drinking problem. What can you do to help me? No alcoholic does that except by way of rare exception. And so we confront him. You have a drinking problem. Now, again, this depends a great deal on prudence, common sense, and experience. What are the right words? I don't know. I know one man whose life was saved by his son, the right person, with the right words at exactly the right moment. This man piddled around the edges of treatment for 14 years. Had three kids, two daughters and a son, and he worshipped them. And he absolutely idolized this boy. And my old buddy was a sloppy drunk. He came home drunk one night. And the boy, to show you how balanced this kid was, how exceptional he was, he graduated in the top five of a class of 500 in the University of Maryland's law school some years ago. Anyway, he was studying one night. He was in college. And the old man came home. He said, hi, Jake. And the boy didn't even lift his head up from his book. He just raised his eyes. He looked at his father and he said three words. He said, Dad, you stink. And old Nels got well. It was the right person at exactly the right moment, and he used exactly the right words. And you and I know of other men and women who have been told that thousands of times and died drunk. I don't know what the right words are. There's no magic wand sort of a thing. I know this for those of you who are married to alcoholics who are still at it. Al-Anon will teach this. Never make a threat you don't intend to carry out. I heard of one case. This was in the beginnings of AA. A rather prominent psychiatrist went to some meetings, and his little wife went with him. And he continued to drink, but he felt that going to these meetings was keeping her off of his back and so on. She hung around long enough to find out that the answer was here if he wanted it. Well, he kept drinking and kept drinking and kept drinking. He came home one night. He was one of these happy-go-lucky drunks. Walked in the house with a big grin on. She's packed. All the bags were packed. And the grin disappeared. And he said, what's this? He was a great, huge giant of a man. She was a little bit of a thing. He just worshipped the ground near which she walked. He absolutely adored her. And when he said, what's this? His wife walked up to him. Her chin came up to his belt buckle, you know. She's a little bit of a thing. She put her finger under his nose and said these words. She has never used this word before and has never used it since. She simply said, you big Irish son of a bitch, you take one more drink and I go. And those bags go with me. And he knew that she meant it. And he got well. He got well. I know many other people who have been threatened that way and died drunk. I don't know what works. I don't know what works. I only know this, that true love is usually tough. True love is usually tough. To do the things that need to be done because you care. It takes great love and great maturity to do this. By the way, I'm going to get off the subject here, but it's on. This wasn't planned, but I'd like to go into it with you. The question of giving advice. We are all experts at it, right? I have 38,000 PhDs in giving advice. But I'd like to tell you a few things that at least I've learned intellectually, even though I don't do them all the time, about advice giving. Most of you in this room are indeed professionals. And if you're like me, part of my very vocation is advice giving. But nonetheless, I'd like to give you a little bit of advice now, and I will break the rule by giving you the rule. Never give advice. Isn't that a beauty? Never give advice, comma, unless it is asked for. Never give advice unless it is asked for, and only then, reluctantly. Now I will tell you how I give advice when I can think long enough to do it this way. Remember what I was telling you about two people looking at the same thing? There's a magnificent story. Now please, you're going to just have to bear with me in this. It's not irreverent. It is just so. Magnificent illustration of two people looking at exactly the same thing and seeing opposites. A marvelous story about an orchestra leader who stopped the music right in the middle of a waltz at a society wedding. And he whirled around, he was beat red, he was mad, he was hostile, he was angry, everything else, the veins were standing on. He said, "Who called my piccolo player son of a bitch?" And some old drunk in the middle of the dance floor said, "Who called that son of a bitch piccolo player?" Gentlemen, that is mild compared to what you will hear in the arguments involved in alcoholic families. I have learned this from experience. Most people are not interested in advice because when you give them advice they don't want to hear, they don't follow it. They're not interested in advice. I'll tell you exactly what people are interested in, and that includes you and me. Backing. I want backing. And couples let themselves, they give themselves away. A husband and wife will approach a priest, and he looks at the priest and says, "We know what's right. Straighten her out. Straighten her out." And she says, "Father, tell him da 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 da." Do you see what I'm after? This is so true in most of us. Most people do not want advice. And when they get it, most people who need advice in the first place very rarely are capable of carrying it out by desire. Many people will do 9/10 of what you tell them to do. The important part they leave out and it fails. And so they say, "You gave me the wrong advice." Very, very often people will come to almost complete strangers. Here is somebody who comes into a rehab center and the bloody dang counselor wants to make decisions that are going to affect a whole family. God, how we can do that, I'll never know. I'll never know. But we do. We sit there and play God just like that. Oh, here, a little for you, a little for you, a little for you. I have learned through bitter experience to give advice in a very specific way. And here's the way I do it. Based on what you have told me. Based on what you have told me. Here is what I think I would do. And then I tell them. And usually that leaves approximately 10 people out of 10 up in the air. They don't want to hear it that way. You know why? The decision to carry it out is entirely now up to them. Based on what you have told me. See, you may have left out a few things. I don't mean deliberately or hiding them. I mean that looking at the situation through your eyes, you may not even have seen the situation as it is. But based on what you have told me, here indeed is what I think I would do. Case in point, ladies and gentlemen, 2 years ago, a woman called me on telephone. I wouldn't know her today if I fell on her. I never met the woman in my life. She was a voice on the phone and presented me with a horrendous family problem. And she went on detail after detail after detail after detail. Anyway, after about 20, 22 minutes, she has finished. She said, "What should I do?" I said, "I don't know what you should do. But based on what you have told me, here's what I think I would do." And then I gave her the advice. She says, "Yeah, but what do you want me to do?" Now, my point will become very obvious in about 2 seconds. She did that 8 times. And hung up in anger because I would not make a major decision for her. I didn't know that woman. I didn't know any of her 4 children. But the advice that I gave would have affected all of them deeply. I gave the advice, but I gave it in a way that it was just that. It was advice. Now a decision, that's your business. Just give me the benefit of the doubt that I'm going to give you the best advice that I know. I have long since, my friends, learned to say, "I don't know," if that's the answer. Beware the person who cannot and will not say, "I don't know," and suspect the jerk that knows it all. God, if sometime in your experience you have never run into somebody who just says quite bluntly, "Gee whiz, I just don't know. Let me ask." You know, if you don't hear that from somebody, usually once a week, something's wrong with him. Well, anyway, that's out. I got a lot of stuff that I just shoot out as the sparks, you know, get ignited. But anyway, that's out of the way now. We'll go back to the confrontation. You confront the alcoholic with the fact of his illness. and offer him an answer. I will help you. Now, before we go on to the answer, treatment, let's take a corollary of confronting the alcoholic. Guideline number 5. Make the alcoholic responsible for his behavior. Now, you remember when I said confront him? That is painful when he is told he has a drinking problem. Hey, by the way, don't ask him, tell him. And in every program that has an alcoholism policy, whether it be armed services or industry, you make sure that you have a knowledgeable network of people who have the results and the effects of his drinking documented. You don't ask him, you tell him, and you document it all. You have a drinking problem. Now, if you're in the armed services or industry, you can always say, now here's what we are going to do about it. All right. Make the alcoholic responsible for his behavior. The principle behind that is the simplest thing on the face of the earth. Quotes, every time you pick up the tab for the alcoholic, you have just bought him his next drunk. It doesn't make sense. And every one of us in this room has covered up for an alcoholic. Every one of us. And we think we're doing him a kindness. We just walk him one inch closer to the grave. You know, even AA says, we made a list of all persons we had harmed, became willing to make amends to them all, made direct amends. The alcoholic is asked now to begin to grow up and to begin to pay his way. The wife who writes a check making good, just gave him permission to write another one. That makes sense. But guess what the wife's attitude is? Well, the whole world will know he writes bad checks. He's an alcoholic. He has a drink. That's right. That's what we're after. That's what we're after. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not talking about moral guilt. I'm talking about legal responsibility. Legal responsibility. You know, in the AA program, and the beauty of AA is to read the steps out loud. We made a list of all persons we had harmed. It does not say we made a list of all persons we had consciously harmed, that we were aware of, that we culpably harmed. Doesn't say that at all. A man could cause damage in a blackout and not be morally responsible for it, but be charged with the damage. I always use a perfectly understandable little parallel. It's like a kid who goes out and hits a baseball that the wind carries through a neighbor's window. All right? He didn't intend to do that. So there's no moral guilt. But he feels a little bad about it, so he goes over and rings the doorbell. He says, Miss Smith, I hit that ball, broke your window, I'm sorry. She said, oh, George, you're forgiven. That'll be $12.98. You pay for the glass. You pay for the glass. Make the alcoholic responsible for his behavior. It causes more pain than he is willing to face. Usually it may precipitate his getting well. Every time you pick up the tab for the alcoholic, you have just bought him his next drunk. And that is horribly, horribly unkind. It just shouldn't be done. This is known as tough love. I once knew a man, I don't know whether he's living or not, he's up around Pontiac, Michigan. He's in AA many years. He had a son in his 20s who was also an active alcoholic. And I remember I try to get back to Detroit about every year if I can. And I was at a meeting and met my friend. He said, well, it took me, I don't know, 3 or 4 years. He said, I finally made the decision. He said, I had to throw my own son out. He said, I just could not be a part of his destruction anymore. He said, I found out that even though it was kind to take his sick and battered body at the end of each drunk and try to get him well, even though that was, as I believe, true love, he said, I found that letting him know that this door was open just to get over drunks from and a place where he could continue in the illness that would kill him, he said, I finally had to decide to lock the door on him. Nearly killed that man. And ladies and gentlemen, to this day, I don't know whether that boy ever got well or not. I just don't know. But I know there was a lot of agony went into that decision. A lot of agony went into it. The love of parents for children is instinctive almost. I'm sure the psychologists have gone into that, whether it's this, that, or whether it's learned, or whatever the hell it is, it's there. And I know parents who love so much and so reasonably, and they still say, I just can't not do this. I know that it is wrong. I know. And here is where, my friends, each of us needs somebody else. Major decisions need advice. AA is so strong on sponsorship. So strong on it. I'd like to make a little plea here to everybody. Every spiritual writer worth his salt speaks of the necessity of a spiritual director. And it's all based on the simple fundamental principle of humanity. No man is judge in his own case. No man is judge in his own case. If you don't have a sponsor, that is those of you who are in AA, if you don't have a sponsor, get one. And if you're not an AA, well, I really feel sorry for you. But in fact, I would suggest you all get a case and go into training, but I can't do that either. But everybody needs somebody whose judgment he can trust. Now, this is purely personal. It wasn't the 12 steps of AA written on a piece of paper to save my life. I could have read them in my room and died drunk. It was a man. It was a man who saved my life. You know how things get done? The inspiration of one human being on another. I can't change anyone but me, but hopefully I can inspire someone else to want to change himself. And that's the way human life works. One time Napoleon, at the height of his power, was reviewing his troops, and one of his lieutenants said, "There isn't a man out there who wouldn't die for you." He said, "Yeah, but I wonder how many of them would live for me." And then he compared armies to religious organizations who have lived in imitation, you see, of Christ. Well, it's the same way here. A man by the name of Austin Ripley saved my life. He saved my life. From the first moment that I met him, I wanted everything he had. I wanted to be just like him. And I'd have died to please him. Ladies and gentlemen, I had it made. I had every confidence in that man's judgment. And it proved to be justified. If you don't have someone, get someone, or you will be the island of misery and remain the island of misery that perhaps you are now. But remember, it takes tremendous sacrifice to do the things that are told me to do. And that is why in the AA community, new people are taught, get a sponsor who will tell you the things you need to hear instead of the things you want to hear. And so it is with life. This whole business of the confrontation of the alcoholic and making him pick up his own tab is something that people like me can philosophize about. But I don't know how in the world you really do it all right. I just don't know. There are a few general principles that we've talked about. But when it comes down to the doing of anything, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. But at least we should arm ourselves with a few principles to act by. That thing about giving advice, the thing about confronting the alcoholic. Very, very often, what is the right time to confront an alcoholic? I don't know. You may have to wait another year and a half for the right time. It isn't just walking up to an alcoholic every time he has a few drinks in him and you're angry at him and you clobber him in the head with this. Then the right time will come and go. Or if it comes and you use it, it'll mean nothing to him because we've wasted so many previous opportunities. I just don't know. I would simply, my only purpose today is just to share these guidelines with you. That's all. That's all. I do indeed believe that an alcoholic should be confronted with the fact of his illness. Let him know that other people know about his drinking. Many an alcoholic has gone to his grave honestly believing that no one knew because nobody said anything to him about it. Nobody said anything. I know a man who opened his eyes on his deathbed, looked at four AA buddies standing beside him. This is in City Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland. He said, "I can handle this." Shut his eyes and died. It was the last thought in his head that he could honestly handle this. He believed it. and he died. Nobody had told him, really. Really. Anyway, making him pick up his own tab is an extremely difficult thing to do. Suppose you have a husband or a son, or a wife indeed, who calls from jail, "I've just been picked up on such and such a charge." Do you go down immediately, as instinct propels you to do, or do you let them rot there for a weekend to have a taste of what it's like so they may not want to do it again? I don't know. I don't know. I don't think you do either, really. But the principle is, every time you pick up his tab, you just prolonged his sickness. So these are tough things we're talking about, but anyway, we will take a break now. And hopefully, a little bit of hope will come in the last session, which we talk about treatment.
Would you know one if you saw one? By Father Joseph C. Martin. Father Martin.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I figure that in this session we'll do the next two guidelines. They kind of go together. Some few years ago, a recovered alcoholic friend of mine had this experience in the Los Angeles area. In a previous drunk, about 2 weeks before this incident, he had had his hair dyed flame red by a girlfriend in the middle of a drunk. All right. This particular night, he and some friends were having a party on the second floor apartment of one of them. And this fellow was rather drunk. He was on the balcony. It was about 3:45 in the morning. He had a telephone in one hand, a bottle of wine in the other, and fell off the balcony. Well, of course, he kind of splattered 6-7 feet below, or however far it is below from one story to another. And he injured his shoulder and his hip. I think he dislocated both of them and broke a couple of ribs. And meanwhile, the neighbors had called the police on account of the noise from this party over in the apartment. So, of course, when the police arrived, they found this fellow crumpled up on the sidewalk there. So, of course, they called an ambulance. They took him to the hospital where his physical needs were patched up. He went to the drunk tank, and I think in the morning he had to stand before the local magistrate and was given whatever it is, 10, 15 days public drunken. Significant, I think. Not one person, not one, from the police who arrived on the scene to the ambulance people who took him and moved him to the hospital, neither the nurse nor the doctor who administered to him, nor the jailer nor the judge who sentenced him, no one said, "Don't you think it's rather strange, young man, to fall off balconies drunk at 4 a.m.? Wonder if you might have a drinking problem." Not one. Would you know one if you saw one? The second guideline is learn to recognize alcoholism through a knowledge of its symptoms. Now, you know, this is like strangling the obvious. It's like stepping out on a beautiful sunny day and saying, "My, isn't that weird? The sky is blue." But it's true. It's true. The failing of human nature is failure to grasp the obvious. Failure to grasp the obvious. Let me give you a few things from my own experience. February 1974, almost 1 year ago, a young 18-year-old serviceman, drunk, racing his car in the middle of the night, decided, for the benefit of a buddy who was sitting beside him, to add to the thrill, turned his headlights off. The car went through a red light, hit another automobile, killed two women, one of whom was pregnant. He himself is married, the father of one child. His wife was expecting her second last June or July. Three lives taken, four lives ruined. Ladies and gentlemen, that kid should not have been in a car. He should have been in care. If a knowledgeable network of people had spotted his problem and done something about it, and his problem was certainly spottable, he could have been diagnosed just like that. Ladies and gentlemen, that automobile accident didn't just happen. That was led up to. That was led up to. 1 month before, out in Oklahoma, two officers of a branch, of one of the branches of our military service, got drunk up in an automobile wreck. Both of them needed surgery, brain surgery. They could have been spotted years ago. Last April, on the island of Okinawa, a two-star general made the announcement that during the previous month, March, he had lost two young servicemen, both of whom had choked to death on their own vomit. It is my opinion that these tragedies were preventable. They should never have happened. But because of ignorance, they did. What sense would it make for me to walk out of here on my way to lunch and stop one of you and say, gee, I think you better see a doctor about that boil on your neck, unless you have a boil on your neck? How in the world can I help an alcoholic for his alcoholism unless I see he's got it? All right, now what's your definition of an alcoholic? What is one? Any alcoholic can be defined through description. We give descriptive definitions of mysteries, don't we? It's what we do with electricity. It's what we do with life. It's what we do with God. We talk about them by describing them. Now, give a descriptive definition of the alcoholic you know. Well, he's a former corporation lawyer who is bumming quarters for drinks down on Skid Row. Beautiful. That's a perfect definition of an alcoholic. But I wonder if it covers the alcoholic. Could you have spotted him 18 years ago when it was all just starting? When he was earning six figures a year, when he was a top man in his law firm, when he was wearing $500 suits, could you have spotted the symptoms that were perfectly spottable back then? I'll tell you one misconception that prevents early treatment. If the alcoholic is still functioning, he can't possibly be one. What do you mean he's only 18? These men were officers. How could they have this problem? Do you know how much money this man earns a year? How can he be an alcoholic? We condemn people to death with just such statements. I will learn alcoholism through a knowledge of its symptoms. Ladies and gentlemen, I submit for your consideration that you do not need to be brilliant to grasp them. If a five-year-old can diagnose this disease, so can you. So can you. Now, I'd like to make a comment here about learning and books and colleges and degrees. Don't get me wrong. Don't misinterpret what I'm saying. I am not anti-intellectual. I taught for 21 years. I lived in a world of books. The only thing I'm asking you to do is not to become too enamored of learning, so-called. Have you ever noticed that many geniuses who are emotional cripples have one bid for attention? They club us over the head with how smart they are. If ever you are tempted to be enamored of somebody else's learning and his degrees, and he's the head of this and that and the other thing, or if ever you're tempted to be enamored of your own learning and your own list of degrees, just remember this. I picked this up recently. Thermometers have degrees too. And you know where they put some thermometers? Ho, ho, ho! Conclusion from that is this. If you want to be an expert in the field, if you want to get into it professionally, if you have to have some goofy degree to get into it, go ahead. But I submit that you can read the symptoms of alcoholism in about a half hour or less. You know, why is it that we have to snow each other with learning and use big words and all this and that? A five-year-old can diagnose this disease. Ladies and gentlemen, go into the home of an alcoholic and talk to the kid. Kid just doesn't say things like, my mother and father are always fighting. Sometimes it's physical. Kid just doesn't always say things like, my father's usually late for dinner. I hate weekends when he's home. I don't like to be around him and so on. A kid gets right to the heart of the matter. A child's mind is just tuned to truth before it can get all bollocks with growing up.
Remember that magnificent story of the emperor's clothes? All the PhDs was, my, what a beautiful cape. And look at the hat. You know, a little kid says he's naked. You know what a little kid says about her father? She gets through the heart. She gets to the heart of the matter by plowing through all of these results and gets right to what's wrong. She says the obvious. My daddy drinks too much. That's the problem. My daddy drinks too much. That's the problem, my friends. All these other things are nothing but the results of it. And what we do with alcoholism is go after causes and all this. I'll give you my definition of the alcoholic. It is based on what we call a self-evident truth. You can't even prove it. You know what you do when you prove something? You get behind it and show it up in a clearer light. A self-evident truth is just that. It's self-evident. I don't know whether you had most of you had philosophy classes, I would guess. I don't know whether you remember this or not, but anyway, there's a thing called the principle of negation. A thing cannot both exist and not exist at the same time. Now, you can't prove that. You see it or you don't. This is my definition of the alcoholic based on this self-evident truth. What makes problems is one. Because it makes problems. That's why it's one. It creates problems. Now, an alcoholic is one whose drinking makes problems. It's simple. It's that simple. If you've got a hole in the sidewalk in the front of your house, and in the last 3 years you've tripped in it and broken your leg 6 times, the hole is a problem. Fill it up. Now, you can sit on your porch and philosophize about causes all you... Well, it's the nature of the clay in this area. It's rather non-porous. And when it rains, it all sloshes down. Horse hockey. If you don't fill the thing up, you're going to trip and break your leg again. The drinker has to be stopped from drinking or he will die from it. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you can slice that melon any way you want, but that's the way it comes out. Please remember this one statement. Drinking alcohol activates this disease. Stopping the drinking arrests the disease. That's the name of the game. Get the alcoholic, quit drinking. Once you get him well, you can philosophize all about it, because he ain't going to die right now from his drinking. You've stopped that. Now you can philosophize. Okay, let's go into some of the symptoms of alcoholism. I'm not going into them all because they're available elsewhere. The only thing I would like to do this morning is very briefly discuss a few, just a few, of the initial symptoms of alcoholism. Because we can all spot the disease and diagnose it in someone who's dying of the disease. It is my opinion, this is personal, it is my opinion that the infallible sign of a drinking problem is lying about it. The lie. You see, I use one question to diagnose this disease. Do normal drinkers do this? The answer is no, you're talking about abnormalcy. Do normal drinkers lie about their drinking? They have no reason to. They have no reason to. By the way, I do not just mean the verbal lie. Wife looks at her husband and says, have you been drinking? Of course, he smells like a brewery. He's ready to collapse. You know, she said, I haven't had one in the last 8 months. And falls down. That's a lie. All right? We all know that. What I'm talking about is living the lie. This is a person who functions in such a way as to try to convince you that he's not drinking when he is. The alcoholic, bluntly, is some poor guy who holds his breath on an elevator for 19 floors so you won't notice it. He's known as the blue species. By way of contrast, get on the elevator with a normal drinker who smells of alcohol, all right? It's only 11 in the morning. You're riding up, you say, hey, Bill, you been drinking? He says, yeah, I just came from a wedding reception. We toasted the bride. Why? The non-alcoholic has no reason to lie about his drinking. The alcoholic does. Now, please, why is the lie an indication of a drinking problem? Basically and fundamentally, because the lie is unnatural. And what makes you do unnatural acts is pretty serious. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you've all read about sexual perversity and unnatural acts in newspapers. By God, the lie makes them pale into insignificance. A lie is a prostitution of the mind. One scientist became a millionaire because he invented a machine that picked up the psychosomatic results of lying. And guess what was behind it? He once made an observation to himself. He said, when I lie, I feel funny. When I lie, I feel funny. Don't you? How many of you guys can really lie to your wives? Gosh, she's got built-in radar. She knows when, you know. And his feeling funny was a psychosomatic result of a lie which he in turn measured with a machine that he himself invented. His name was Keeler, and the machine is the polygraph. And that's what's behind it. A lie is unnatural. And when you're drinking makes you lie about your drinking, you have a drinking problem. No ifs, ands, or buts. You have a drinking problem. A little bit later, we'll tell you exactly why alcoholics lie about their drinking. Gulping and sneaking drinks. Normal drinkers don't do that. How many of you people know a normal eater who goes to a closet to eat a hamburger? Drinkers drink this way all the time and laugh at them. Have you ever embarrassed someone who is sneaking a drink? He's out in the kitchen where the supply is. He's got a big one all fixed up there. And he's just about ready to pour it down. You walk in. Hi, Harry. Hi there. How are you? I don't know what to do with it. Normal drinkers don't have to do this. If any of you men were to go home tonight and see your wife sneak out of the dining room, into the bathroom, open the toilet tank, pull out a bottle of milk, drink three shots of it, you have her committed in about 5 minutes. We watch alcohol drinkers do this all the time, kind of get a kick out of it. We're all children of the attitudes of our era and of our country and of our race and everything else. I wonder how many of us, if we had been in the Merv Griffith audience, would have laughed too. I suppose most of them. In any given office, there's a man or woman who has to go to the bathroom 8 or 9 times before lunch, on Mondays, on days after holidays. If you know anything about alcoholism, you know why. Poor girl has a hangover. She's heard only about 20% of what has been said during the day in the office. She's shaken to pieces inside. She knows that the whole world is looking at her. She just can't really function. She needs a drink. Alcoholics drink where you can't see them, so they head for the lavatory. Guess what the rest of us do? She gets up, picks up her purse, heads toward the John. We wink, we nudge, and we giggle. And she's dying. Isn't that hilarious? Isn't that hilarious? Why don't we diagnose it then? Simplest reason on the face of the earth. When that girl gets back to her desk, she's the best. She's the best. And functioning and alcoholism just don't go together in my preconceived misconception. She's still functioning. How can she be an alcoholic? That's why we miss it. All you have to do is ask your question, and the obvious almost hits you in the skull. Do normal drinkers go to the toilet to drink? Not usually. Guy gets up from his desk, he's heading out. Where are you going, Charlie? Get a martini. You don't go there for a martini. But the alcoholic does. The alcoholic does. That's the symptom. That's the symptom. The alcoholic is a fellow who has an alibi system that would choke an elephant. Everything is behind his trouble. Never drinking. If she'd only keep her big mouth shut, there would be no drinking. He is now functioning E over I. He is led by feeling, not by reason. His child knows he has a drinking problem. His co-workers know he has a drinking problem. His bosses, his wife, his neighbors, they all know he has a drinking problem. He's the last one to admit it. And since he functions E over I and we think he's crazy, we send him to see a psychiatrist. And what he needs is to get sober.
Father Martin's talk will continue on the other side.
Turn tape. Do not run.
alcoholic's mind, you see, is functioning backwards. He's looking at causes and calling them results. He said if she'd keep her big mouth shut, there'd be no drinking. Well, if there were no drinking, her mouth wouldn't be open. You know, I'm minded of a magnificent story that illustrates the way an alcoholic's mind works. There was an old lady down in the Ozarks. She's about 89 years old, and she was seen for about 3 straight days pulling a solid iron chain. It was about 100 yards long, pulling this thing, a step at a time, almost falling down at each step. Finally, one old man said, "Granny, what are you pulling that chain for?" She said, "Do you ever try to push one?" That's the way the alcoholic's mind worked. He's pushing chains instead of pulling them. His mind is working backwards. We can all see this. It is so obvious. It is so obvious. Where do we learn these symptoms? I mean, I could go through them here now forevermore, but you learn it from literature. There are books and pamphlets. And by the way, the best literature in the entire world is AA pamphlets. Reason? Number one, they're brief. You can read them in less than 20 minutes. Number two, they're free. Number three, there's not a wasted syllable in them because, number four, they are written by pros who have been there. You can learn from movies and lectures and seminars and institutes. But you will learn best from the man who owns one. You know how they teach men to be flyers? They put them in a classroom for so many months, and then they put them in an airplane with somebody that does know how to fly. Your kids right now, you know how they learn to drive a car? They have to put in 30 hours in a classroom, then they get in a car with somebody who does know how to drive. Now, I submit this for your simple, simple consideration. If you were going to buy a pair of roller skates, I don't think you'd go to a Dodge dealer and ask about performance. You want to know something about alcoholism? Yeah, somebody has been there and knows what it's all about. A lot of these jerks that write books about alcoholism probably haven't been on a decent drunk in their lives. See, now, that's one of my adverse attitudes. But anyway. So you know what I'm doing now? I'm inviting all of you to attend a whole lot of open AA meetings. AA meetings are of two kinds, closed and open. Closed is just that. It's real dyed-in-the-wool therapy where alcoholics share with each other. An open meeting is just that. It's open to anyone who's interested. There's one area of the country in which, before every AA meeting, a prologue is read. It spells out a definition of AA, what it is, why it is. And this is the last sentence. We welcome and appreciate the cooperation of the medical profession, the clergy, and the public in general. So you're all invited. Now, many non-alcoholics, that's the last place in the world they're going to go. They'll be experts. They'll treat alcoholics. So have you ever been to any meeting? You want to know some of your own basic attitudes toward alcoholics? I can see some of you non-alcoholics setting out some night, walking into an AA meeting. You know, wonder who's looking. And then when you get inside, well, how will they know I'm not one? How will they know I'm not one? Most people wouldn't be caught dead at an AA meeting. And yet they profess to come to things like this and say they're really interested. Most of them wouldn't be caught dead at an AA meeting. There is still the stigma of... It's not filth, really. It's just a little coating of slime. And we don't want to be associated with that at all. But anyway, that's where you're going to learn it. That's where you will learn the symptoms. Here's where you will learn that one alcoholic is different from another. Here's where you will learn that what works for one does not work for another. Here's where you will learn the difference in detail, but the sameness of nature. You know, when Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson got together, they were men of two divergent backgrounds. Their drinking was the same, and yet it was different. And if you listen to enough thousands of alcoholics talk about alcoholism, their own, you may indeed begin to get a little notion of what this mystery is all about. Guideline 3 is nothing but a corollary of 2. It is one of the things that you will learn about the disease, but it is of such utmost importance that we treat it separately. Learn that alcohol is the center, the prime reality and the governing force of the alcoholic's life. This is one of the things you will learn about alcoholism. That alcohol governs the alcoholic. This is what makes him different from the non-alcoholic drinker, the non-alcoholic non-drinker. He is controlled by his addiction. The substance governs his life. Now, ladies and gentlemen, once you realize that, the seemingly irrational behavior of the alcoholic makes sense. I have seen people in this field ask questions that they should never ask at all because they have not yet grasped the fact of addiction. Alcoholism is addiction to drug alcohol. All right? Addiction has two elements in it, compulsion and progression. The alcoholic drinks the way he drinks because he can't not drink that way. Please believe this. If willpower could handle alcoholism, there would be no alcoholics. Every alcoholic has willed to not drink. And so, once you know that without proper therapy, the alcoholic will drink because he has to, then be prepared when he says never again for him to get drunk. Be prepared when he says never more than 3 for him to drink 23. Once you know the nature of what's wrong with him, he drinks against his will, you can predict everything that's going to happen. Now, please, let's go back to the graveyard. When somebody looks at you and says, well, I know a man who showed up drunk at his mother's funeral, you say, of course he did. That's what's wrong. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is where I came to my conclusion. When one's drinking causes problems, and doing something like that is a problem, that is the drinking problem that I call alcoholism. Well, he told me a lie, and you could see that he was lying. Yes, alcoholics lie when you know they're lying. Now, do you want to know why alcoholics lie about their drinking? Alcohol is the center, the prime reality, and the governing force of his life. If he talks to you and tells you the truth about his drinking, you're going to tell him to not drink, and he can't do that. And so the lie becomes natural to the alcoholic. Let's get to treatment just briefly. I know of a man in one of the branches of our armed services who maintains that he can cure this disease in 10 days by using electricity. The man is a fool. Here's an alcoholic who has lied and broken his word and broken promises and broken pledges for 18 years. Electricity never handled a sense of remorse, my friends, and here's a man who's lived with it all his life. The treatment for alcoholism has to take into consideration the nature of the disease. Alcoholism, this addiction, is illness of body, mind, emotion, and soul caused by the compulsive use of beverage alcohol. The treatment has to restore health of body, mind, emotion, and soul by stopping the drinking of alcohol and substituting a new way of life. And any therapy that doesn't do this ought to be blasted off the face of the earth. I know this is slight rambling, but I think it's to the point. Anyways, once you understand that alcohol controls his life, you understand why he associates with the people he does, why he goes the places he does, why he keeps the hours he keeps, all according to his own pattern. Alcohol dictates all of this. The will is almost gone. It's almost gone. When an alcoholic says never again, he means that. He means that. When an alcoholic says never more than 2, he means that. Getting well is not a question of goodwill only. It's a question of taking the proper medicine. And if the therapy is not proper, then when a man with all the goodwill in the world, he'd give his soul to back up his sincerity when he says never again, and he's drunk 2 days from now. And anyone who knows anything about alcoholism says, of course he was drunk. He's not using the proper medication to get well. He's not using the right medicine to get well. Anyways, for those of you in the room who can't understand compulsion to drink beverage alcohol, try on any of the other addictions. There are 5 basic addictions. narcotics, alcohol, food. There are people who run into closets to eat hamburgers, but they are not natural eaters. They are not normal eaters. They are compulsive eaters. Then the other two, gambling and work. Now, everybody knows a work addict, the compulsive cleaner. Maybe you live with one. Maybe you are one. But have you ever been in a home that is so clean, looks like nobody lives there? You feel guilty about having your feet on the floor and there's nowhere else to put them. You're sitting there, she empties the ashtray 20 times in an hour, and you don't smoke. Just clean, clean, clean. Now, we can laugh at that addiction because the results are nothing. There's nothing antisocial about the compulsive cleaner. But boy, the ramifications of compulsive drinking are legion. They're legion. It controls his life and it explains him. You begin to predict the antisocial behavior. By the way, that's another symptom, the antisocial behavior of the alcoholic. I usually say so many times, it's perfectly normal to stand on pianos and sing songs at parties. That's what we have parties for. But the alcoholic will go into a neighbor's house and hop up on his piano with his golf shoes on and puke on his floor. That's frowned upon. That is not normal activity. How many of you can look at the alcoholic you know and say, he's a wonderful fellow when he's sober? When he's sober. When he's sober. I have to learn this disease in order to know what it is that I'm helping someone for. And if he has it and I don't spot it, he will probably die before I can help him. Ladies and gentlemen, they tell me that there are certain types of cancer that are so insidious that when they get to the stage where they can be detected, it's too late. Just too late. It is almost that with many alcoholics. But hopefully, precisely because of people like yourself, this illness is being diagnosed early. And people are being gotten into treatment. At a facility where I help out at once a month, there is a 13-year-old patient. I met a young kid in Washington the other day, 16. And the under 35 groups in AA are just mushrooming around. So let's learn the disease so that at least we can diagnose it and get alcoholics into proper treatment. But anyway, we have to have proper attitudes. We have to realize the symptoms of the disease in order to know that it is there, the main one of which is this compulsion to drink alcohol, the compulsion to drink alcohol. Willpower has nothing to do with this disease. And ladies and gentlemen, before we break up for lunch, I'd like you to consider this one thing. If there are any of you in this room who still feel that alcoholism is immoral, I'm not talking about alcoholic behavior. That can be very immoral, and that is why AA therapy demands that they take a moral inventory. I'm talking about the disease, the moral, the morality, the moral nature of the disease. If any of you think that an alcoholic is blameworthy because he has this disease, let's try this 5-second exercise. Let's everybody in the room go back to age 12. You're in the 7th grade. Mentally, close your eyes and write on a slip of paper what you want to be when you grow up. How many of you wrote drunk? Nobody. Nobody. No one is an alcoholic by choice. We'll see you after lunch.